Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of Nation of Writers. This podcast is presented in conjunction with our virtual exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of Zora Neale Hurston, who was simply extraordinary. She grew up in Eatonville, Florida, an all-black town, leaving home in her teens and working menial jobs in order to finish high school. She arrived in New York in the 1920s to study anthropology at Columbia University and quickly took her place as one of the stars of the Harlem Renaissance. Fieldwork fueled her writing, most notably Mules and Men, a collection of African-American folktales published in 1935. Hurston also used lyrical, evocative prose in the works like 1937's Their Eyes Were Watching God to bring black stories, voices, and places to life while exploring feminist themes well ahead of her time. Hurston is featured in the American Writers Museum's special exhibit Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice, on display now. For this episode, we are joined by Tiari Jones and Lindsay Stewart. Please take a look at their extensive bios in our show notes. Tiari and Lindsay are interviewed by Nate King, Digital Content Associate at the American Writers Museum.
Well, thank you, Lindsay. Thank you, Tiari, for joining me today. I'm excited to talk about Zora Neale Hurston with you both. Let's hear a little bit about yourself. What have you been up to recently? Any projects you have coming out? Lindsay, let's start with you.
Well, thanks for having me. So right now, what I'm working on is a book of narrative nonfiction on conjure women. So I'm trying to think about how conjure provided African-American women a way to value themselves in a world that largely didn't value them or disadvantage them. And I'm looking at it in roughly four historical periods. So enslavement, looking at what they called Negro mammies on plantations, and then to the Reconstruction period, looking at voodoo queens, then on to the Jim Crow era, looking at granny midwives, and then all the way up to the Civil Rights Movement. And I kind of want to make soul divas like Aretha Franklin into a conjure woman. So we'll see if I can pull that off. But that's kind of where I'm going for this project, looking at how conjure women were able to shape American culture. And we're really kind of thrust into some central periods of American history.
Wow, that sounds fascinating. Tiari, how about yourself? What have you been up to recently?
Well, I've been doing a lot of things. I'm working on a new novel, and I feel like it's sprouting little green leaves. So I'm really glad that the writing is coming back to me. I'm always afraid that it won't come back. But I've also been doing some other kinds of writing. Like I just got back from Zambia, where I went on a 10-day safari. I'm writing about it from Travel and Leisure. And I was apprehensive because I didn't think that I was a person that, I'm a very indoorsy person. I'm not an outdoorsy person. And also I felt like I was worried that a safari was going to be kind of inherently colonial, inherently racist. But I ended up having a really great experience. And after being locked in the house, you know, with the pandemic, to be outdoors in that kind of way was pretty amazing. And I'm just grateful for the opportunity to write about it. It'll be coming out in Travel and Leisure in a few months.
That's great. I love that you mentioned the different kinds of writing. So that's one thing in my research of Zora Neale Hurston is all the different forms of writing. She took on the sort of kind of journalistic approach, the anthropology aspect, the fiction, the short stories, the essays, letters. So with all that in mind, I'm curious if either of you remember the first time you read something by Zora Neale Hurston. Tiari?
Well, I first encountered Zora Neale Hurston when I was an undergraduate student at Spelman College, which is a historically Black college for women in Atlanta. And we read one of the short stories, I think it may have been Sweat, one of those short stories. And I was confounded by this kind of phonetically rendered dialect. I was like, what is this? Is this even English? And I had a very kind of dramatic English teacher, and she performed the story for us. And it's like, after I read a little of it, listened to her, I got the hang of it. And it gave me an appreciation for not only the type of language that Hurston was reporting or recording or dramatizing through her writing, but also as a writer, it made me realize how difficult it is to capture verbal language in a written form.
I think in the, you mentioned that in the introduction to the hitting a straight lick with a crooked stick. That's what I've also been fascinated by in reading Hurston's work, is the not only the commitment to that, but also the ability to pull it off in a way that, I don't know, that resonates with me, even as someone who, like I was saying earlier, I'm from New Hampshire originally, so I'm not, you know, that that sort of Southern dialect is not familiar to me, but I can, I feel like I'm hearing it there. And Tyra, you wrote, no writer before or since has regarded the language of the African-American South with such affection and seriousness. Unfettered by respectability politics, Hurston lets the people speak for themselves, and speak they do. And I liked that because it, she writes in their own voice and lets them, you know, have the, tell their own stories in a way, even though, you know, she's writing someone else's stories. But what do you think the importance is of that, of to be unfettered by respectability politics? And I think, Lindsay, this ties into your book as well, The Politics of Black Joy, about Hurston and neo-abolitionism. So I'm curious what the, if you could kind of expand on that, Terry, about the, you know, how letting someone, like letting someone's own voice shine is important.
Well, one thing you can tell is that Zora Neale Hurston has such fondness and affection for the people about whom she writes. Because a lot of time when people's speech is rendered phonetically, it can come off as very condescending. Particularly when you have one group of characters who are thought to speak the real English, and then you have another group of characters where it seems like they are approximating English or misunderstanding English. But because she creates universes where everyone in the universe, their speech is rendered in this way, then it seems like she's elucidating and trying to, as the anthropologist in her too, is showing that she's trying to capture a way of communicating that is, it's virtually lost now. I think that so much regional speech is gone. It's become homogenized by everybody watching so much television, but she has fun with it. And she never punches down. And I think that's also part of what she did. I don't think it could be done. I mean, who knows? I can't say what can't be done. There's a genius out there. There's a little baby genius in its crib right now, getting ready to write a book that's going to prove me wrong. But I don't think that there is anyone else writing right now that has that same ear for speech and that kind of magic of translating this thing. You know, because speech, what you hear is so ephemeral, and she somehow or another catches it and is able to pin it on the page. And that, I think, is a miracle. And the respectability politics of it, because these ways of speaking were always seen as efforts to speak English that failed. Like, this is what people do when they can't speak properly. There's a sense of not wanting to cast your Black characters as people who are somehow unable to talk, unable to speak English. But in Hurston's hands, because she's not worried about what some other, well, I can't say she's not worried, but she's not worried much about what some other people may think. Her, it's almost like she wants to be accountable only to the people about whom she's speaking. And that creates a different standard and a different bar.
Yeah, that's well put. Lindsay, what do you think of that?
I mean, I love the thing that you said, Tiari, about creating this universes. Part of what I've been kind of really fascinated with lately is speculative fiction, like N.K. Jessamyn, but also a Kwaki Emezi. And it's almost like it's a way for them to define themselves and to be, like Tiari said, accountable to kind of these Black people that they're very much so fond of and interested in, and not worry so much about the white people who may be privy to these conversations. I mean, it's something that infuriated a lot of Hurston's contemporaries, that she, it's not like she didn't know that white people were there. It's just, that wasn't who she was talking to. And it's kind of like, if white people were around, I think she just kind of expected them to not really understand, even, like not even have access to our inner lives in a way that they can participate in the conversation in a way that makes sense.
Yeah, in your book, Lindsay, it was Hurston's emphasis on Black joy was more like a refusal to entertain the white gaze. Goes on to say, she strove to maintain an emotional indifference toward whites, relegating them to the periphery of a Black world. You mentioned her contemporaries at the time too. I'd be fascinated to hear more about that and sort of what what the grain was that she was going against at that time. Like what was sort of the kind of overall philosophies or thinking about expressing the Black life what Hurston did compared to what her contemporaries did.
I mean, as a world of Hurston scholarship, so I won't speak for all of Hurston scholars. But I'll answer it in a way that gets back at your question about kind of what was the first thing that you read by Hurston.
Oh, yeah.
For me, I also encountered Hurston first in undergrad. But what I read was the essay, How It Feels to Be Colored Me. And the way that they taught that essay was they paired it with Richard Wright's Blueprint for Negro Writing. And one of the issues with that is that without enough context on Hurston, which I don't think we got, it almost looked like, well, Richard Wright had the right racial politics and Hurston just was kind of oblivious to racism. And part of what I try to do in my book is work out a story that explains some of Hurston's views that we tend to think of not really jiving with some of her contemporaries like Du Bois or Elaine Locke or Richard Wright. And one of the ways that I try to get at that is to reposition Hurston. A lot of times we tend to think of her in relationship to the Harlem Renaissance, and that's definitely important. But I think we should also think about her in relationship to the abolitionist period and think about how she's also trying to respond to this pressure that she felt to reduce Black people or kind of represent Black people in her work as responding to white people, as responding to the suffering of racism. That's there, right? She doesn't deny that that's there, but kind of in the language of where I grew up, she wouldn't study white people. That wasn't the main thing that she was interested in conveying kind of Black life. And it really upset a lot of other people who were writing during that time about Black issues.
I will say that I've always kind of struggled with Hurston and that essay, How It Feels to Be Colored Me. You know, she says, I am not tragically colored. And I agree because I don't feel tragically colored. Although, she was grew up in a rural Southern space. I grew up in an urban Southern space, but I also grew up in an all Black world. I grew up understanding Black people, the concept of Black people as a minority was very much an intellectual one for me, much in the way we understand that the world is, 84% water or something. It's like you believe the world is 84% water, but you also feel like if the world is 84% water, how are we sitting here? So that's kind of how I felt about whiteness and white people. But I also think that Hurston sometimes I do agree that she wasn't, particularly in her writing, wasn't terribly concerned about white people. I think that's not exactly true for her life, but in her writing, and that is what we have, that's what endures. But I think she sometimes was, in my opinion, a little overly interested in thumbing her nose at some of her contemporaries, which is why How It Feels to Be Colored Me is probably a little less nuanced than it could be. I mean, you have to say that, people are getting, this is in the height of lynching. This was not terribly far after, Red Summer. And she's saying, I'm too busy. I don't worry about woe is me. I'm too busy sharpening my oyster knife, which is awesome. But we also know that's probably disingenuous, right? Like she's the level of oppression of that time. I do believe her oyster knife was in fact sharpened. And I think she probably also occasionally wanted to shank somebody with it. But that is not the performance of herself that she wanted to put out there at that time. And I get why, but I suspect there's a little more going under the surface of that essay than she wanted to share with the public at that time.
You definitely get that when you look at some of her letters, right? When you look at the this wonderful compilation of letters that Carla Kaplan edited that just has been so important from our research, and you get kind of a little bit more insight into why she was kind of performing Black joy in the public sphere in a way that infuriated so many of her contemporaries. I think she was contrarian to a fault. So yeah, a lot of it was, you said something about me, so I'm gonna say something about you, and you know, I don't care who hears it. And that's why I think sometimes you either love Hurston or you hate her, because she's very in your face about that. But I do think there's a kind of consistency to her views that we don't always grant her. I think she was very much so worried about some of the tactics that we were using and saying, I don't think these are going to work. And so there's some letters where she'll just say, they want me to write about lynching, but everybody knows about lynching. And it's not like white people don't know that we're being lynched. So what is telling them we're being lynched? What is telling them that we're suffering? How is that going to move them? And you kind of have to dig into the way that Hurston, I think she was deeply pessimistic about what white people could do for Black people. I think she really felt like racism screwed with their head. So kind of appealing to their conscience, at least in the way that she thought people like Du Bois or Richard Wright were doing, wasn't going to work. There wasn't a conversation to be had because they weren't going to give up their power, and kind of telling them that we're suffering, we're being lynched, and we're angry about it isn't going to do that.
And what's really interesting, though, is that in her, you know, with her saying that she is writing, you know, by for Black, you know, FUBU, you know, for us, by us kind of writing. But the fact that she did not choose in her work to really engage the emotional toll of racism, even for her Black audience. I don't think that because she wasn't talking to white people meant she couldn't talk about white people. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I just feel like it just, you know, I get it because as a novelist myself, I do feel that there are a lot of people who think the role of the Black writer is to fill in the gaps of history. And if you're filling in the gaps of an established history, then that established history is, in fact, your subject. And you are creating like a supplemental text to an established text, which means that other text is controlling you. And I completely understand how frustrating that is. And also how frustrating it is when people assume they know your subject matter before they know you. Mm-hmm. And I think she was pushing back on that. And I feel like in my own work, you know, I wrote a number of novels primarily about Black people and their families, because my family is where the primary emotional conflict is in my life. And mm-hmm. I didn't know why I should be expected to write a novel about the conflict that isn't the conflict that obsesses me. My family obsesses me. And so that is what I write about. And it's not that I am necessarily rejecting to say that racism is not a worthy topic, but for my, you know, my first three novels, that it wasn't my mm-hmm. ministry. And I think that is also what Hurston did. Like she believed, rightly so, that Black people have a lot of things to say about a lot of different topics. I do quibble with her on the fact that she couldn't get neutral enough to say, that's Richard Wright's ministry, this is my ministry. It seemed like they were doing a lot of fighting about who has the right ministry and not understanding that there's a lot of work to do. And we have to do, all of us have to do our work simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she could get vicious about other people's ministries too. She knew how to write those zingers. I mean, she would have been a queen of Twitter today.
Can you imagine if Hurston was on Twitter? Instagram? Oh my goodness, Clubhouse? TikTok?
Yes.
Oh yeah, the visual aspect, yeah. The hats, right? Yeah. So that being like one of our newest exhibit, which opened in September, is called Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice. It spans like the, you know, end of the Civil War to it's kind of through the civil rights movement of the 1960s. So that kind of 100-year period there. And one of the centerpieces of the exhibit is 16 pieces of artwork that were commissioned specifically for the exhibit. four artists, three of which are painters and one who is a fabric artist, Dorothy Burge, based here, all of them based here in Chicago. But so one of the 16 writers featured is Zora Neale Hurston, and it's a quilt that Dorothy Burge created. And it's in the hat, one of the iconic hats is a big part of that quilt. And then the other part of the exhibit is, or part of this artwork in the exhibit is there's an augmented reality portion. So you take your phone and it reads this, a symbol that was embedded into the artwork, and then you further explore on that writer's life. But what you were just talking about, and the different ministries and the lineage of writing, specifically Black writing, we explore that in the exhibit. And as I was reading your book, Lindsay, it mentioned the narrative of early abolitionist writing was about suffering, right? It had to be the suffering of Black people, of enslaved people, had to be the crux of the story that you were telling. Otherwise, it wouldn't be authentic, quote unquote, or not authentic to the eyes of Northern white people, essentially. But I like how it even starts. You mentioned Frederick Douglass in that section, who he also wrote about the racism of that abolitionist, of the white abolitionists, who wanted him to just be the figure. Didn't I forget the exact quote, but basically they said, leave the philosophy to us. You're essentially just this, this symbol. And that's kind of where that exhibit starts, right? Is, Frederick Douglass and Ida B. Wells and sort of that end of post-Civil War Reconstruction era. And then it goes all the way to Zora Neale Hurston and beyond. I'm just curious if you see any, either of you see in today's world that sort of lineage continuing, or perhaps, you're both kind of doing those similar work, but any sort of responses to either of those different ministries that you see today, or people perhaps carrying writers that today carrying the torch, if you will. Like I said, you both are doing it, but curious if there's anyone that you can see writing in the same vein as Zora Neale Hurston today.
I think Zora Neale Hurston kind of reminds me of Toni Morrison in this. Mm-hmm. I was just talking to someone and I said, Toni Morrison, I don't see her so much as a game changer in African-American literature because she was so singular. What are we going to do? We cannot get up in here and try to write like Toni Morrison. We can just roll around at her feet in awe and gratitude. But I do think Hurston's long legacy actually is one removed, because I don't think there's anyone writing like Hurston now, but Hurston influenced Alice Walker. Alice Walker changed the game. You can divide, I think, Black literature in before and after The Color Purple. Mm-hmm. After Walker, people started writing about different topics. After Walker, Walker read Their Eyes Are Watching God, which she read as a fundamentally feminist text. It was really one of the very early texts that was critical of marriage as an institution. Mm-hmm. And because marriage is the height of respectability, right? That's interpersonal respectability is marriage. And Hurston was critical of marriage, which one just did not do. It just wasn't done. And then when Walker wrote The Color Purple, where she is interrogating the institution of marriage, and one of the first popular African-American women novelists to basically admit that patriarchy exists, admit that gender violence exists. After Walker, lots of people started telling their truths in a way they would not have. And that is the long arm of Zora Neale Hurston.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. She really just opened up the space for us to talk about what are the problems that we have and how we relate to each other and families, with partners. And that's so important. Yeah.
And Janie shot TK. One true love, because of course, he had been bitten by a rabbit dog. I mean, one had to, but that kind of the woman literally choosing herself over her one true love had not been seen. Like, that was not a possibility in a novel that is understood to have a happy ending. Mm-hmm. just like Walker, The Color Purple. You know, Celie gets rid of Mister, has a relationship with her husband's mistress, and then ends up being an entrepreneur, and her husband and all of his problematic hypermasculinity is sewing with needle and thread, talking to her. And for Walker, that is a happy ending. Like, Hurston reimagined the happy ending, because as far as Hurston is concerned, if Janie is happy, it's a happy ending. Right. I don't care what anybody else is doing. The question for her is Janie happy? Yes or no? Then it's a happy ending. Walker, it's like, is Celie good? Celie good. It's a happy ending. And that is also their influence, the way that they centered the narrative on a Black woman's happiness. They, both of them are like, whatever it takes to get there, that's the happy ending.
The way that you put that just reminds me so much of Harriet Jacobs' narrative, and how she tells us that, you know, her narrative doesn't end with marriage. Marriage isn't the happy ending for her. It's freedom.
Yes, yes. But she also makes it seem like marriage was, she was deprived of marriage.
Yeah, Jacobs.
Yeah. She kind of like, yes, for me, for the slave girl, it is freedom, but not marriage. Like, we don't have the luxury of marriage. Mm-hmm. And the person is like, I guess I can look at it that way. I get, I mean, you could, but.
Wow. I'm curious why you mentioned the long arm of Zora Neale Hurston, her reach, and who, you know, who she has affected and impacted other writers. But if you were to, if, you know, someone were, who has never read Zora Neale Hurston before, were to ask you, why should I read her today? What would you say?
I kind of don't understand that question. Sorry.
That's fair. It depends really who you're talking to. Like, if I was talking to a high school student who might be a reluctant reader, I would definitely tell the reluctant reader, you know, do it for the plot, just for the good time of it. Back to Black Joy. There's so much pleasure in the experience of reading it. And I think this is something that is under discussed when talking about African-American literature. Our work is so often talked about, like, eat your vegetables, learn about the world, instead of just the sheer page turnery about how Janie left her three husbands. Like, if somebody leaving three husbands, that's something you can read on your vacation if you want. So, I mean, there's that. And then there's other people, you would tell them to read it just like, if I was telling someone who was a writer, I definitely would have them read Hurston to look at the way she privileges in getting the language just right, and how the challenge of trying to capture how people talk on the page. That's because it can't, you know, what does Morrison say, that language is an approximation? And how close she gets in her approximation. So that's one reason. And then I think the nonfiction, I would have someone read it just to think about, because it's still relevant to how we look at the experiences that we're having today. And how do you still tell your experience and document your pleasure, even in the midst of the horrific time in which we find ourselves?
Yeah, I like that, the document your pleasure aspect. That scene, yeah, this seems to be important to Hurston's work, and also just to anyone, really, right? And, you know, you just mentioned, you know, the world we live in now, this is completely speculative. We don't know, but how do you think Hurston would be engaging with our current world in all its all the bad things happening?
What would Hurston tweet?
Kind of, yeah. Well, that's what made me think when we were talking about Twitter earlier, or like,
I mean, yeah, I don't think we'd like what she'd be tweeting, and she would have been canceled so many times.
And come right back.
And come right back.
I think she would laugh at a lot of, I think, you know, she, I wonder sometimes how someone like Hurston would have responded to, say, the Obama era, because you know, people who are accustomed to their lane, speaking truth to power is their lane. What happens when we are the power? I think it would have confounded her, but I think she would have found something to mock.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. We won't speculate about what it could be, but yes, she would find something to mock. But I also think, I think that Hurston would be really interested in the way Southern language has changed. She'd be trying to keep up with these, she'd be trying to figure out what these mumble rappers are mumbling about and trying to figure out how you can express that on the page. That's what she would be doing right now.
She'd be all over Beyonce. She would just be like the top.
I think.
Oh, yes. Because of all of the West African stuff and Beyonce's stuff, all of the, especially Lemonade, I would totally would see her all up over that.
I think Hurston likes an underdog too much. I think Hurston would be championing someone we have never heard of.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think she, I don't think she'd be into someone that has such popular appeal because that's not her lane. I think she would be, you know what, she would be like, yeah, I just feel like if it's something everyone's into, it would be like you said, we wouldn't like what she would tweet. It would be everybody except for Zora Neale Hurston, who would say, down here in Eatonville, we got a girl that's three times as pretty.
Oh, yeah, she probably would say that. She probably
whose mama is an actual conjure woman.
Yeah.
Whose mama is an actual conjure woman. Mm-hmm. That's what she would say.
No, I disagree. I think she'd be totally into the Beyonce. Like, she would probably not like the person of Beyonce, but she'd be interested in the cultural things that Beyonce's produced.
Yeah, I was just kind of going to ask something along the lines of that. Like, would it be like the, you know, Beyonce's art itself, maybe she'd be really into.
She totally would say that we do it in Florida better.
Yeah.
What is this Texas thing?
Yeah, I really think she actually would. Like I said, she would say, oh, well, you know, down in the swamp, there's a girl down there. And all of y'all jumping up and down about Beyonce, but we got a girl down here. Her name is Sadie. And if you've ever heard her sing and yeah, she's throwing bones, you know, whatever. Like, that is what I think. I think, again, Hurston would not co-sign on what we're doing. She's not going to, she goes against the grain.
Yeah.
Her whole mission is to ruffle your feathers. She's not going to smooth your feathers.
Yeah, but Beyonce doesn't smooth everybody's feathers. There are a lot of black people that hate Beyonce.
Well, I mean, indeed there is, but I just think,
like, she would be against that strand that's like, we hate Beyonce. I think that with internal fights among black people, she's usually with Beyonce's kind of the underdog. If you're talking to progressive political black people, it's like, oh, I'm not a Beyonce fan, but that tends to be the response.
Beyonce is an underdog. May we all be underdogs.
I'm not saying she's an underdog in the world. I'm saying internal discussions that black people have. I don't know.
I do think Beyonce has detractors. I just don't think that's her. We don't know. We'll never know. But I just don't think that's Hurston's lane. I think Hurston would do something that would, Hurston would bring our attention to someone that we don't even think about.
Well, yeah, she'd talk about, I don't know, the African artists that Beyonce collaborates with and be like, we really should be interested in them, not Beyonce.
I could see her saying, I mean, that's the thing. Like, she was so, Hurston was so, like, again, against the grain and off in these kind of wild, unpredictable spaces. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm saying, like, we would just, whatever Hurston would be into right now would be something that would shock and blow our minds and open us up to something we have yet to think about.
Yeah, it's just to some degrees, things that are contrary are also very popular in American culture. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Maybe you'd be into TikTok, but everybody's into TikTok now.
Yeah, this is maybe me characterizing it wrong, but I never got the sense that she was like contrary just for the sake of being contrary, right?
She was.
Yeah. She was.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, she enjoyed. I mean, that's one of the things right. that she enjoyed. She enjoyed shocking people. that was her jam. That was her complete pleasure. And the thing about people who are really, I think that is one thing about Hurston and our memory of her. I think that we as modern admirers of Hurston, in our imagination, she would shock and appall other people, but not us, but she would. Absolutely. And that would, she probably be that, that's how she rolled. And I just hate that I wasn't alive at the same time as she was.
I'm kind of glad. I don't think I would have liked meeting her. Some people like to, you know, make you feel really uncomfortable. Like they get pleasure out of the discomfort you feel. And I'm just not that way. And I don't, you know, I love people who are like that, but I don't know that you necessarily want to be around them all the time.
Yeah, it's fun reading about them historically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think Hurston is definitely one of those people that it's a real pleasure to hear about how she annoyed Countess Cullen mm-hmm. and all that. Mm-hmm. You know, but yeah, she might think we're uptight.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I think she would kind of hate some of the Black stories that we have on TV now. And I think like her criticism of that sometimes we focus too much on like oppression would still be relevant. I think that's still something that she would be saying. I think there's some things that she might like that are kind of more underground, like Insecure, that's really just about this like group of Black women, young Black women trying to navigate LA. But I think some of like the things that are more popular with us, I think she'd have things to say.
Yeah, she'd be like, I like the awkward Black girl, she would say.
Yes.
I don't know when it went on HBO or Showtime, whatever. I don't know. Like she would be like that. Like, cause she's very distrustful of institutions. Mm-hmm. And so when people collaborate with institutions, she'd be like, I don't know. And we need those people. We need those people who to constantly pull our coat from the other side to help us remember, you know, from whence our art sprang. So I think that's super mm-hmm. important, but I think it would be super frustrating also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Just make us think about something else, like think about the same thing in a different way, right? Like,
and it's like how, you know how like Ishmael Reed will drive you up the wall, but we need Ishmael Reed, even as we are being driven up the wall.
Right. It's like you were mentioned earlier with the, you know, the different ministries, right? The, you know, the Richard Wright ministry. You need both of them doing their version of the work at the same time. And yeah.
I argue more than both. You need all. Like we need it. Right. Right. I mean, I feel that even in my own work, for example, I have a novel called An American Marriage. It's about a young couple separated by a wrongful conviction. It is more about what happens with the couple, with the inner dynamics of the dynamics of their relationship drama, and the implications of that, because the new Jim Crow exists, because there's so many other works that kind of like stridently talk about prison industrial complex. I didn't feel that then I have to write a novel about it because I don't feel like that narrative isn't already out there. So the more narratives are out there, the more people can kind of niche out. And that's why we need a big multiplicity of voices so that people can get as specific or as broad as they choose and not have to have that anxiety of feeling that I didn't tell the whole story. Which is why in the 20s, when they were all fighting about which ministry is the right ministry, is because there was a sense of the story hasn't been told. So each of us has to decide what is the story. But all this, you know, 100 years later, we don't have that same pressure as artists and scholars, because there's so many stories. And that is the great gift that our forebearers have given us.
Well said. Definitely gives me something to think about. Well, you know, as we kind of start to wrap up, was there anything that that we didn't mention that you wanted to talk about? Zora, her work or your own work, or, you know, how her life has impacted your own? I think we covered, you just kind of mentioned that, Tayari, but anything else that you wanted to share?
I mean, I think I see Zora as a kind of intellectual friend. While I was in graduate school doing philosophy, I was struggling because I felt like there wasn't really a space to talk about how Black Southerners live their lives and why that's important in philosophy. Zora helped me articulate why that's important. And she's someone that I like to struggle with. There's some times where I'm just like, oh, I don't know that I can go there with you. But she really pushes me to think more deeply about things as well. So I consider her an intellectual friend. And I think that's one of the best things that you can have in a writer, is an intellectual friend. Not someone that you always agree with. I think that's kind of boring. But someone that can push you to think about things. Someone that you can struggle with.
Well, thank you both very much for joining me today. And yeah, I hope you have a great rest of your day, and look forward to reading more Zora Neale Hurston, that's for sure.
It has been a pleasure. It was so great to speak with both of you and to talk about Hurston, because she is truly an American treasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you would like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.